Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 286. Do you have complex logic and unpredictable dependencies that make it hard to write reliable tests? How can you use Python's mock object library to improve your tests? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher shares details about his recent Real Python video course, Improving Your Tests with the Python Mock Object Library. He describes how mocking in Python with unittest.mock allows you to simulate complex logic or unpredictable dependencies, such as responses from external services. He covers how the mock class can imitate real objects, and the patch function lets you temporarily substitute mocks for real objects in your tests. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a collection of recent releases, using open source AI at Wagtail, updates from the inaugural PyPI support specialists, a lightweight OS for microcontrollers and MicroPython OS, why Matchcase is not necessarily a switch case for Python, thinking about time in programming, a TUI-based presentation tool for the terminal, and a tool to check Django projects for dead code. This episode is sponsored by Agent Field. Most of us think of AI as a chat window, but what happens when agents move into your backend, simulating market scenarios and acting on them, routing patients across hospital networks, optimizing fleet logistics in real time, all autonomously? That's the AI backend. Agent Field is the open source framework for building it. Search Agent Field on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hi there.
Well, we got a typical episode. We got some news. In fact, I'm going to do some news after because we're through the main one. And then our typical topics and some projects this week. You ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So what kind of news you got for us this week?
I've got just a very small collection, mostly release stuff. First off, a bevy of Python packages. 3.13.12 and 3.14.3 are bug releases with a little bit of security fixes spread throughout them. And on the continued road to October, 3.15 Alpha 6 came out.
Wow.
And not to be outdone by three Python releases, Django has three of its own, 6.0.2, 5.2.11, and 4.2.28, which cover a couple of denial of service and a couple of SQL injection vulnerabilities. So go get your patch on.
All right. It's nice to see them continuing their security releases here. All right. Well, instead of a first topic, I have a roundup of news items that I wanted to talk about a little bit more. And I have three of them. And some of them are sort of follow-up things that I kind of want to mention here. My first piece is a follow-up from a Real Python article that I covered 2 weeks ago about Ollama. That's the ability to run, you know, local LLM models on your own machine. And I wondered about other possibilities for models and which ones really work well with Python, et cetera. And I found this post that was from Wagtail. It's their core team member, Tibod Kolas, and the title of it is Open Source AI We Use to Work on Wagtail. Subtitle, What's Working for Us Right Now? And if you're not familiar with Wagtail, it's Django-based, kind of following your last news item there. It's an open source CMS content management system. So think of taking the features of Django and adding even more built-in features that are geared for content management. And the piece begins with this quote, if you've been using AI tools but haven't tried open source models yet, you're missing out. Here's a quick recap on what we found to work well with Wagtail projects and things you can try right now. And so their first paragraph was about why it's worth your time. Two reasons, agency and capability. Sure, frontier large language models and $200 subscriptions can do a lot, but they fall short in critical aspects of, and this is a link to another piece they have here, our ethos when it comes to AI adoption. And from that link, which I'll include, they have a heading, which is their principles. For AI, here's what we've arrived at for now. No AI dependency inside of Wagtail Core. Responsible approach to AI, high alignment with our values, ethical, sustainable, transparent, and so forth. Model and provider agnostic, compatible with a wide range of open source models. Only the right AI, focus on the use cases where there is a definite improvement. Human in the loop, preserve the user's autonomy and agency. So they mentioned using Ollama, again, following up from what I was saying before, and then another tool called LM Studio, which I'm going to try to check out, which I think is kind of pushing it more into another like IDE type of setup. The key part I wanted to share are the models, which I was not familiar with. There's so many different things to look in this space. So it's nice to hear somebody say, hey, this, you know, not only works with Django stuff, but Python. They mentioned Mistral. Mistral Small, and another one called GPT-OSS. There is a link about why they choose it and the model's footprint as far as environmental and so forth. Qwen 3 Coder, which is available in a wide range of sizes. Kimi K2.5, which happens to be in the top 10 of coding agents. And Apertus, and this one would be good if you're looking for something with multilingual support. If you don't know where to start, they mentioned two that can run in a much smaller environment. So you have an older machine, not a lot of RAM, another RAM crunch thing to kind of think about today. They mentioned Minstrel 3B and then smaller LFM 2.5. All the links are in their piece to all these different things. They mentioned some other tools that are in this vein. Prompt Foo. You can have like three different models comparing how they respond to particular prompts. And they also have a handful of other tools, Jan, which is a chat GPT replacement, OpenCode, a CLI coding harness, Continue, if you'd like an agent inside of your code editor, and then something called AnyLLM, which is from Mozilla, and it's designed to integrate your application with a provider model. So just some follow-up with lots of other research and tools that you can kind of look into if you're interested in running LLMs locally. My second piece is a follow-up from my interview with Maria Ashna, which was episode 258. I had titled it Supporting the Python Package Index. And Maria, if you haven't listened to that episode yet, is the inaugural PyPI support specialist. And she's written up how the first year and some change has gone. In fact, the title is Dispatch from PyPI Land, a year, parentheses, and a half as the inaugural PyPI specialist. PyPI now has reached over 1 million users and has over 700,000 projects. Prior to stepping into the role, the account recovery backlog was 4 months behind, and PEP 541 backlog was a year and 4 months behind. And she's happy to report some highlights from her tenure. Account recovery backlog is now current with an average triage of 1.5 days. PEP 541 backlog is current as of December 2025 with an average triage issue response time of about a week. Between July 2024 and December 2024, 725 account recovery issues were resolved. And between, I guess for the year of 2025, I should just say, it's easier to say, 2,221 account recovery issues were resolved. Last year, the PEP 541 issues, they resolved approximately 500. And that has to do with naming and some other stuff. You can listen to our interview to go a little further there. Nice work, Maria. Good updates. I really don't hear people complaining too much about PyPI lately, which is actually, I think, partly them getting some people in these roles and things running smoothly there. So my last piece is, I think you guys might know if you've listened to the show for a while that I'm interested in embedded systems and programming for, you know, portable things. This piece is by Jean-Luc Offranc from CNX Software. Embedded Systems News is the title of the newsletter. And the title of the piece is MicroPython OS, Graphical Operating Systems Delivers Android-like User Experiences on Microcontrollers. My wife's joke is so not so micro anymore. Anyway, so MicroPython OS targets applications with graphical user interfaces and is heavily inspired by Android and iOS. It has an app store, an LVGL-based touchscreen. I was not familiar with LVGL, but it's a light and versatile graphics library. Link included below. Button UI, plenty of widgets, gestures, theme support, and a Wi-Fi manager, as well as over-the-air firmware updates. In fact, those are the first five pre-installed apps in it: a launcher, a Wi-Fi configuration tool, app store, OS updates, and settings. I'll include a link to the homepage, and they include a bunch of stuff on there, like how could you use this? Smart home controllers, educational tools with interactive displays, portable touchscreens devices, robotics with cameras, smart wearables with gesture controls, and other kinds of DIY projects you might look at. I'll include a GitHub link into there. And again, a link to the project page with their documentation. The homepage has a great first line: the only operating system built with MicroPython. It has screenshots of example apps, UI samples, and so forth. And it can run on ESP32 microcontrollers, but you could also run it on a desktop if you want, Linux or macOS even, Android-like touchscreen UI with gestures. It says that it supports, you know, obviously touchscreens, and then IMUs, which I was not familiar with that term. That's for robotics. Inertial measurement units are a part of robotics as a device that measures and reports a robotic's specific force, angular rate, and sometimes orientation using accelerometers and gyroscopes. The whole idea is fast and light and, you know, performant for these kinds of devices. So if you're interested in embedded devices or making a little touchscreen device of your own, I think MicroPython OS seems very interesting. A quick word from our sponsor, AgentField. Most developers still think of AI as chatbots, but move agents into the back end and something wild happens. Agents running simulations to optimize pricing, orchestrating logistics across warehouses and carriers, triaging security incidents automatically, resolving insurance claims end to end. Not a human using chatbot, but autonomous software. This requires real infrastructure, identity, authorization, and scale. AgentField is an open source framework for building backends that reason, like APIs and microservices, but intelligent. No DAGs, no rigid pipelines. They're defining a new category, the AI backend. Search AgentField on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. What do you got first here, Chris?
Well, a few weeks back, my latest RealPython video course came out, and it's on Python's unit test mock library. As part of its batteries included philosophy, Python ships with unit testing support, and one part of that is the mock library. Mock allows you to dynamically replace code with other code, so-called monkey patching. You might be thinking, how does replacing the code I'm testing help me test the code? Wouldn't that just be removing the code being tested? And you'd be right, but sometimes replacing the correct chunk of code makes it easier to test. I think the way I use mock the most is when my code deals with dates and times. Say you've got code that behaves differently based on what day of the week it is. Maybe it's lazy and does nothing on the weekend, but works especially hard from Monday to Friday. To properly test this kind of code, you could test it twice, once during the week and once on the weekend, or you could fake out the behavior of the date-time module. To properly test your code, you don't actually want date-time to do its job. In this case, you want to control it, and that's what mock lets you do. The core part of the mock module is an object also named mock. That's not confusing when we're talking on a podcast. But normally with a Python object, if you call a method that doesn't exist, you get an exception, but not so with mock objects. No matter what method you call on mock, it always returns a new instance of a mock object. This seems a little strange at first, but it is the first step. It doesn't crash for the method not being there. Let's say you had a function that took an object as an argument and then calls methods on that object. Instead of passing in your regular object, you could pass in a mock one, and all of those calls would succeed. You might do this if the calls were particularly expensive, like using a network or a database. Sometimes that might be good enough. Simply allowing a dummy call to happen might be enough, but most of the time you need a bit more. Mock also allows you to define the behavior of the fake methods, explicitly setting a return value or triggering a side effect like an exception. Chime, incoming in 3 seconds. Everything in Python is an object.
Yes.
That includes the methods on an object. So methods are just a subset of functions, and functions are objects in Python. You call a method using parentheses, but if you leave those off, you get a reference to the method instead. And like any other Python object, you can assign properties to that method. This is how you define the behavior of these fake methods on a mock object. Let's say I had a method called counter. I could define a property on it called return underscore value and setting that property to 3. Then when I invoked mock.counter, instead of returning a copy of a mock object, the default behavior, it would return 3 instead. There's also a similar mechanism for other behavior through the side effect property. By configuring a mock object's methods, now I can pass it into that expensive function before, and I can specify exactly how it will behave, faking out any interface for the function's use. The mock module has more than just the mock object, though. The tool I probably use the most is patch, which dynamically replaces code with a mock object. You can call patch either as a decorator or a context object, and you configure patch by passing in a string which specifies what you're going to be patching, what you're replacing. Then, within patch's scope, the thing you specify gets replaced with a mock object instead. The string's a little tricky, and it can be a bit of a challenge to wrap your head around. Say you had a Python file called picnum that imports randint from the random module. This function, like the name implies, randomly returns an integer in a range. Like with my date example from before, when testing, you might want to control the result rather than use an actual random number. Inside of your unit test script, you configure patch with the string picnum.randint. Here, you're not replacing randint in random, where it's defined. You're replacing randint in picnum, where it's being imported. That takes a little getting used to, but it's a good thing as it means you won't actually be replacing randint everywhere else in your code, only in this specific instance. Once patch replaces randint with a mock object, you can then configure it to behave the way you want, like returning the same value, which of course wouldn't be very random, but is much more predictable for your tests. So the course covers the mock object, shows a few different ways of using patch, has an example of the most common case dealing with date-time objects, as well as more detail on how to spec out a mock to make it a little safer to use. It was a fun course to write. I hope you give it a try.
Yeah, I learned a bunch. There's some nice uses you have at the tail of it that I was like, oh, that's really cool and sort of instructive of like actual ways of implementing this tool. So thanks.
It's one of those features of the language that I have to look up every time I use it. Like I remember that it's tricky and it's like, how does the patch string work? I know it's not what I think it is. And then I have to go and look it up. So now that I've written a course on it, maybe it'll sink in this time and I won't have to go to the docs as often. We'll see.
Yeah. So my next one is from Trey Hunter, who we feature often. It's on his Python Morsels site. It's titled switch-case in Python? It's not match-case. He starts with explaining how people who are new to Python, you know, coming from another language potentially, they might be familiar with switch case statements. I'm from SQL, which I mention often here. That's one example. There's a few other languages. And he suggests in the title that you may not want to use match case. Instead, there might be another method. And through this process, he goes and explains partly how match case is much more complicated and powerful. In fact, the name is structural pattern matching. It was included in the 3.3.10 release of Python. So, gosh, 4 years and change now. For a deep dive on this topic, we have a Real Python article, Structural Pattern Matching in Python. You can check out. I'll include a link for that. And he says he's going to write a little bit more about it. His quote at the beginning of this, the match statement has a different way of parsing expressions within its case statements. That's kind of an extension of the way that Python parses code in general. And he shares a bunch of code examples to give you an idea of what of the types of things that are possible. It doesn't go all the way through. In fact, he admits that he's only scratching the surface here and that he'll cover it more later. For this article, he wants to show the concepts that then argue for a different solution for someone who's looking for something that's more like a typical switch case type statement. So the first one is matching iterables. Python's match statement can be used to match an iteral based upon the number of items that it contains. So if you're sending a list or some other kind of iterable item in here and it contains, you know, several items or just one item, you can have it behave differently. So the example that he provides shows how you can match like different types of points. So let's say if you're only given X, it would be a one-dimensional point at X. If given two, matching in that particular case, it'd be a 2D point or X and Y. And then a 3D point, it would have the example of an X, Y, and Z point. And the match statement can also match an interval based upon its actual values. So like the first match he has is a value of like maybe it's like a video game or something like that. In this case, if the values move, then the second thing would maybe potentially have up, down, left, or right. Or maybe you're matching a value that's turn, and then you'd have the amount of like degrees. The match statement can also be used to match an object based upon its type. He gives an example of that. Other things based on the presence of certain attributes. So only if certain attributes are there, you have certain values come in. And then the final example is really advanced, and I'll let you look at it here, but he gets into that concept of parsing, and we've talked about before in the show of abstract syntax trees, the AST module, and he has it doing this elaborate nested pattern matching where the match and case statement is actually like embedded, going through and indented multiple times as it goes along, and is using a match case statement to parse what's coming out of the AST module. Again, the ability to have code parsing as part of the match statement is very powerful, but can also be rather complex. So then he shows a common pattern that a lot of people think of as a switch case type problem. Going back to your date and time thing, he uses an example of categorizing based upon the day's name. Okay, based upon these names, would it be a weekday, a weekend, or maybe it's an error or invalid? In that one, he shows it as match case, and then he shows it just using if and elif inside of Python. He argues that certain code blocks look a lot more readable doing this with if and elif than doing it with match case. You're not indenting as much. And most coders, if they look at the if elif, they would probably be able to parse it much quicker. And not necessarily everybody understands the match case statement, and maybe they haven't seen it. I don't know. After 4 years, I would say it's becoming more commonly used. And then he shares the key insight, which was kind of the thing he was leading to in the beginning, using a dictionary instead of creating a switch case type logic. He shows an example of HTTP codes. Those are the codes that if you get a response from a website, you get these code returns. If code equals 200, return okay. Elif code equals 201, return created. 404, you know, not found, and so forth. And you could make this very elaborate logical path of if and elif statements going through and converting your input values into the more readable output values. But Python has a data structure for mapping data like this built in. It's called a dictionary. And the next code example starts with the dictionary being created first, having status message equals, and then your curly brackets, and then 200 colon okay, comma 201 colon created, and so forth. So you, at the beginning of your code, you have this nicely formatted example of all the different status codes in their names, and then a function and goes through def, get status code, and then you're giving it the code as the parameter, and then return status message dot get. In that case, it looks at the code and either returns whatever the particular value is from the dictionary, or it has a default value of unknown status. It's really readable. It's also really easy to update. You know, if you play around with a little bit of his code, you can kind of get an idea of what he's trying to say here. A long if elif chain looks like a lot of logic, but is often disguised as logic. A dictionary makes code that can be data heavy, but not very logic heavy. And so his final suggestion is keep match case statements for more advanced uses. So thanks again, Trey.
Yeah, there's a trick there you can use as well that he doesn't get into, which I guess would be the next level up, is again, because functions are objects in Python. The other thing you can do with the dictionary is put the reference to a function in it. So instead of it having the status message, you map based on the dictionary to a function and then invoke the generic version. You're basically looking the function up and then invoke the generic version of it. So if you've got a lot that has to be done for each one of those error messages, you can have a function for each one of them and have the dictionary do the mapping, and then you just generically call it. So yeah, there's a lot of power there if you want it. Yeah.
Yeah. So your keys and values, you know, your keys would be similar to what we were talking about, but the values in this case would be actually functions being returned.
Yes. Yeah. And then typically what you do is like the signature of each one of those functions would be the same. And then you would pass in like the request object or whatever the equivalent is that gave the information, and then the functions can do something with it. And of course, they don't have to be the same one, right? So like in the case of HTTP codes, like all the 200s mean roughly the same thing. So you might have one function. They might, so 200 and 201 could map to the same function.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, or you can get crazy with it and have a tuple where it's like the function and the message that goes with it, and then pass the second part as arguments into the first or whatever, right? So yeah, yeah. There's a lot of flexibility there, and it makes for relatively easy to read code, because like you said, you've got that sort of...
Yeah, if you define it at the beginning, right? And you can just see it.
You've got that sort of declaration-based thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I like that about it. And then, like, I was able to play around with this code in the REPL just to kind of check it out, and I was making, like, F strings and having, you know, calling to the actual function inside of it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like in some ways a little more, there's some flexibility there. It is not necessarily like simplifying everything, but I think, you know, again, from a readability state, I think it actually could probably be a little bit easier to parse for some people.
Yeah. I'd also forgotten that match case was 3.10. And seeing as 3.9 died at the end of last year, its support is done. I guess I can start using Match.
You can start using them.
I can start using Match in my libraries. That's fine. That's yeah. It's across all supported versions now. Look at that. Time marches on.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. And it's the one that was mentioned earlier in this episode. When you're writing a Python application, tests are essential for verifying that your logic is correct, reliable, and efficient. Complex logic and unpredictable dependencies make writing tests challenging, and that's where the Python mock object library comes in. And this course is titled Improving Your Tests with the Python Mock Object Library. It's based on a real Python tutorial by Alex Ronquillo, and the video course is presented by my co-host, Christopher Trudeau. And he takes you through creating Python mock objects using mock, asserting that you're using objects as you intended, inspecting usage data stored on your Python mocks, substituting your mocks for real objects using patch, and avoiding common problems inherent in Python mocking. Across the course, you'll explore how mocking enhances your testing strategy by enabling controlled and predictable test environments for your Python code. And like most of the video courses on RealPython, it's broken into easily consumable sections. Each lesson has a transcript, including closed captions. And where needed, you'll have access to code samples for the techniques shown. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. So what do you got next?
My next article is by Shan Ruff, and it's titled How to Think About Time in Programming. This isn't a Python-specific article, but covers the different ways you might use time when programming. We've talked in the past about the trickiness of things like time zones, but this article takes a step back and kind of categorizes how you might use time when you code. Shan's opening paragraph even mentions the frequently given advice of, hey, just use UTC, and how that sometimes actually isn't the right answer. So he introduces the article as a conceptual model for thinking about time. So it's a kind of a bigger picture sort of approach. The first category that he talks about is absolute time and distinguishes between durations and instants. The example given is how a duration describes how long it took a runner to finish a 100-meter race. I should adjust that on the fly for a speed skater given the recent Olympics.
Yeah, there you go.
So when Stephen Dubois won the gold for Canada in speed skating, the duration was 40.835 seconds. The instance was February 18th, 2026 at 3:30 p.m. And let's not get into the fact that that instance isn't useful unless you actually talk about the time zone, but we'll get to that later. So durations on their own can be problematic, as you often need to associate them with an instance. For example, Dubois' race duration was in most of the news articles, but the instance of it required me to actually go digging for the schedule. So those are kind of two different ideas here. One of the most common instances in programming is the Unix epoch, which is January 1st, 1970 UTC. And by specifying this known instance, any time can be expressed as a duration relative to that epoch. Well, with a few complications about storage size, which I'll just whistle past that for now as well. The next category of time that he talks about in the article is civil time. This is closer to what you were taught in grade school. I'm not going to invite you to lunch using a 9-digit number. This includes minutes, hours, days, months, and years. Civil time in the Western world is based on the Gregorian calendar, which itself is based on a kind of epoch, January 1st, year 1 of the Common Era. The article doesn't touch on it, but if you scratch that even lightly, the blurb quickly runs into problems. Common Era is also known as AD. Gregorian isn't the only calendar system, and in fact replaced the Julian in the Western world. And that's without even getting into complications like the fact that countries can't agree on what order years, months, and days are used within a short form. So time can be complicated.
Yeah.
No, you're not even going to touch it.
I give you a big smile.
You're not going to make me mock Americans.
No, all right. I'm totally fine with year, month, day. I'm a programmer.
I was sufficiently patriotic that I mentioned a Canadian Olympic win, so we'll just get moving on. The next category in the article is modern timekeeping, and it includes a little history lesson. Our timekeeping systems are based on the idea of a 24-hour rotation time of our planet and a 365 quarter orbit duration around the sun. The problem isn't just that those are wrong, but also that they change. Earth's rotation fluctuates over time and can be affected by things like earthquakes. And since the idea of our orbit time is based on the number of hours in a day, which fluctuates, well, you run into problems. To account for this, scientists occasionally adjust the internationally recognized time with leap seconds. I think I've established that this is all very messy, and my summary so far is only about 20% of the way through the article. Shan goes on to talk about UTC in detail, the messiness of time zones, daylight savings time transitions, the IANA time zone database, and then has a bunch of great use cases giving advice on, hey, if you're programming this, then you should time track this way. All of this is a very deep dive and quite a useful resource. So if you are running into date time problems, you might want to read this to get the bigger picture.
The only Olympic thing I wanted to mention is I saw the doggy crossing the finish line in the cross-country ski. Everybody cheering and the camera following it instead of the winners. I'm like, that's what happens. All right, that gets us into projects. My project this week is a TUI-based presentation tool for the terminal. And we like to feature, from time to time, textual projects. And this one is called Prezo. It's from Abelian Open Source Projects. I'll include a link to it. They do a variety of other projects. So Prezo, again, is a TUI-based presentation tool built with textual. It displays presentations that are written in Markdown using conventions similar to those of, I don't know if I've talked about MARP before. It's something that we use at RealPython to help us make slideshows. There's another one called DeckSet. Inside of that, you're working inside of a Markdown document using certain formatted text to create things like dash, dash, dash indicates, oh, that's your next slide and so forth. And I think this would work really well for someone doing like a technical presentation. You might already have a terminal open and just open up another window or what have you. It's all text-based, though you can display images in it. They have examples of that. I'll mention just some features to highlight here. You use Markdown to write your presentation. So again, it's very small as far as saving it. It can do a variety of different column layouts, incremental lists. When you're running it, you have live reloading, keyboard navigation. Typically working in the terminal, you might not be using a mouse. Slide overviews, a table of contents, even presenter notes and a time and clock, and a whole bunch more. It looks really well documented. I like that about it. Covering installations, common uses, a list of those handy keyboard shortcuts, and an example of Markdown documents and how it will translate. In fact, it has like a full-on user guide with a getting started tutorial walking you through a variety of presentation examples. They show you how to include front matter inside of that, styling a text, selecting themes, and so forth, along with how to export your presentation either to HTML, if you're going to present through maybe a web interface, or a PDF, or slides individually as, say, PNG files, if you'd like. So again, if you're looking for a presentation tool that's really lightweight and can run in your terminal, and I really could imagine seeing this running inside of different conference talks and things like that. I think it might be a good way to do slideshows. So yeah, check out Prezzo.
They're part of a bigger ongoing project that's going on in France right now, which is sort of a joint between private and government and trying to provide a bunch of open source tools for things that traditionally are purchased licenses. So there's some very interesting stuff going on inside of this space right now.
Is abandoning Teams and Zoom one of these other things that's part of it?
I believe that's one of the things that's on the roadmap, yes.
Yeah. I totally understand. Anyway. What do you got for a project?
I've got something called Django Dead Code, and it's by Andrew Miller, who goes by Nano Republica on GitHub. Inside of most web projects, you have a separation of concerns. You've got your code, which is triggered when a user hits a URL. You've got a route, which maps the URL to that code. And then you've got an HTML template that is used to render the actual page. Your template probably includes links to other URLs, and depending on how complex your site is, your routes might point to different pieces of code based on what HTTP method's being called. Django provides tools for all of these things. For example, you can name a URL and then reference that by name in your code or templates so that if you change the URL, you only have to do it in one place. And it's kind of like having a global variable. But what happens if you refactor your site and get rid of some of the code? How do you make sure the corresponding route and templates get removed as well? Depending on your code, they may need to stick around or they could be dead. So what the Django Dead Code library does is look for these kinds of code mismatches. It comes as a Django command line tool, and when you run it, it goes through your routes, views, and templates and looks for dead stuff. It will identify routes that aren't mentioned in the templates, which means the user can't click something to get to them. That's not always a problem. It could be an API or something. It knows how Django class-based views are structured and what their corresponding templates get named, so it looks for those files. It understands Django's redirect and reverse functions and how they reference routes. It will read templates and look for unused extensions, and will even examine the contents of any variable that has template in its name in case you're dynamically determining what template to use. This is a pretty exhaustive list of possible places dead code can hide. You might get the occasional false positive, but if you're cleaning up a Django project and want to get rid of your cruft, this tool could help you do it.
I wonder about that, like where these things sort of come from. I mean, obviously projects change as they go along. There could be like you're copying and pasting code, or maybe you're building off an existing project. And then I really thought about LLM stuff.
Yeah.
It potentially creating routes and things that don't exist. Need to be there.
Traditionally, this kind of thing tends to come from some sort of refactor, right?
Yeah.
So you build, if you're doing APIs, you often have versioned APIs. Well, although you might have a version 2 of the API, it might call some of the same functions that version 1 of the API does, but some of the code might go away. So when you go to deprecate version 1, you might remove some of it, but not all of it. You might not get all of it, right? It's refactoring that tends to, or traditionally caused it. Yeah. Generative AI. Yeah, Alexa. Let's end the show on a positive note and not go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. It looked like a cool project.
Yeah, it's neat stuff. And he seems to be actively doing it, because like one of the notes was, these things used to cause false positives, but now I've changed code that fixes that. So like he's obviously going through and trying to make sure he finds some real use cases, which is, it's some cool stuff.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris, for bringing all these projects and articles this week.
Always glad to be here.
All right. Thanks to AgentField for sponsoring this episode, 1,000 Agents Coordinating Autonomously. That's not science fiction. That's what they call the AI backend. AgentField is an open source framework for building AI backends that reason, just like you'd build APIs and microservices today. Search AgentField on GitHub or visit agentfield.ai. That's agentfield.ai. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.